Hey, microphone at a good height for short people. This is great. Hello, my name is Tanya, and I'm standing too close to the microphone. My name is Tanya, and I'm a site reliability engineer at Google, working on infrastructure. But I'm going to open with a story for my first job. This is an extremely high-resolution image of my first desk, with a shout-out to the book that got me through the first year and several other years. I was a systems administrator at a small software house, 40 developers working on middleware of some kind, and maybe that can help you place the year, and four or five salespeople and one sysadmin. That was me. Look how happy I am. Someone is paying me to do Unix all day. I still don't really understand how this is possible, but this is the world we're living in. It's amazing. So here's our company's LDAP server. This is a really dumb place for it, but this is where it is. This is a big red power switch on a power strip that everything in my desk area is plugged into. And if you don't have a sense of foreboding here, then you've probably made really good life choices, and I commend you. But remember that big red power switch, because it's going to be interesting later on. This is a box of screwdrivers and other useful tools that is sitting on a desk right above the big red power switch. Here are some papers and folders and ring binders. The papers get changed very often. It's got some like ISO 9000 certification where we have to, every time we do a backup, print out something and put it in a folder. And you know, this changes every day. So what happens? So in honor of this being a talk about 1998, I will use a popular technology of the time. Slide transition. Because obviously this happened, obviously it did. It was an exciting day. So my company didn't have a postmortem culture because I don't think that was invented yet. But if they had, what is the root cause here? Like, we can say it's an accident, but accident usually means we haven't thought about it real hard. We can certainly blame the operator, the person who put that last piece of paper on top clearly wasn't careful enough, but they weren't really set up for success either. And you know, we can say it was an act of God, but there's this great Terry Pratchett quote where he says, it was an act of God, but you were standing on a hilltop wearing wet copper armor shouting, all the gods are bastards. Like, you kind of had it coming. This is what it was. It was a trap. Of course it was a trap. It was a trap created by past me and sent into the future as a little horrible gift for the future person. This, if you forgive me, cascading failure, wouldn't necessarily have happened on any particular day, but it was going to happen eventually. And when it did, the consequences were really bad. It was a trap because it forced the user to act perfectly. So I'm going to talk about seven different traps that I see all the time in production. And this is the first one, assuming a perfect user. So there's this great story in Wired last year, which I think was also in the Google SRE book, about Margaret Hamilton finding a bug in the Apollo module. And so she discovered this pre-launch program that if you ran it, would reproducibly crash the simulation. Reproducibly. Absolutely a bad bug. Don't run this program. So she went to her bosses and she said, you know, I'd like some time to fix this. And they said, no, just the astronauts have no reason to run that program. Just tell them don't. So document that they shouldn't and they're perfect. They just won't. So obviously the astronauts ran the program, because of course, and it blew away all the navigation data. And this story ends with Margaret Hamilton and her team on the ground spending 9 hours getting new navigation data to the Apollo module so that the astronauts could come home. Because they're not perfect, because they're humans. Everything we do, everything we create, is meant to be at some point consumed by humans. You know, we write documentation, we make monitoring, we write tools, we write code, we build production environments. We want humans to interact with these things. And the humans might be users of your product who are paying to use it. They might be your colleagues. Very often the user of this thing you're making is you in the future. So kind of the same you looks very similar, has a different context. Probably slightly grayer hair, doesn't remember what you were thinking on this particular day. And humans aren't perfect. A lot of the time, humans aren't confident. Like, how sharp do you expect, how sharp can you depend on your colleagues being at a random point in the future? How sharp do you think you will be randomly at 3 a.m. when a page goes off? Can you depend on it? So if you can't, and I think you probably can't, what can you do now to take a little bit of extra time to send a gift to the future, to help them out, to help this person out. So, like, you imagine, you look at your system and you imagine a sleepy person using it, or a distracted person, or somebody who's really stressed out and flailing, or someone who's got 20 minutes between meetings and is pushing the pre-launch program to see, you know, what it does. You know, what can you do to let that person blunder around without a box of screwdrivers hanging over a big red power switch like the Sword of Damocles? I think of this as sending a small, inexpensive gift into the future. It's like sending someone a cookie. Cookies are the opposite of traps. It's like a little gift from past you. And one of the most common ways we send messages into the future is documentation. Documentation can be such a cookie. It's so, like, so delightful. But it can also be such a trap. Like, obviously there's documentation that's just wrong. And that's good, and that makes us happy. And this documentation, like the Margaret Hamilton story above, which is, you know, clearly just a Band-Aid over a bug. You know, document the bug is here, please walk around it. Just fix the thing. But the best and the worst documentation is documentation that just hates you. Everything about the documentation is true. There's nothing you can point out that isn't right, but it's laid out in such a way to just subtly lead you in the wrong direction. Here's a real-life example. This is a true story. So your colleague just left. You need to delete their account. And I don't know, there's an account removal thing that disables their badge and, you know, takes them out of the company database, whatever. And it's not in your path, so you go look at the documentation. And here it is. And most people copy this. And most people paste it. And most people read it before hitting enter. But not everybody does. And or they accidentally copy a new line. It's pretty easy to do. And they're not especially careful because they trust, falsely in this case, that the documentation does not hate them. So if you take one thing away from the talk, just make it be this. Do not write documentation that deletes your CEO if you run it. Don't do that. That's not a nice thing to do to your colleagues. I told this story, and Donovan Barda at Google told me about a tool or an automation framework he'd worked on where they were trying to avoid exactly this problem. So in all the examples, they added this flag, do not paste this. So, you know, if you copied and pasted it, it would say minus minus, do not paste this. The first bug filed against the tool. Guess what the first bug filed against the tool is? Does not understand the do not paste this argument. People, come on. What do these traps have in common? It is the element of surprise. This image cracks me up. It's the element of surprise. It's defying user expectations. It's violating the principle of least astonishment. There's a lot of ways we do that. There's a lot of ways we set up systems that behave in surprising ways. Like special snowflakes, the thing that is not like the other things. In the pathological case, none of the things you work on are anything like the other things. And that's a really bad gig, and you should consider your choices. But more to think, typically, you've got a way of doing things. You've got a config push, you've got like a standard, you've got a policy, and then one day a thing comes along, and it's sort of not quite the same, and it would take a lot of work to make it be quite the same. And you're busy, and everyone's busy, and you think, this one, I'm just going to remember that this one is different. I'll document it. I'll remember that this one is different. You will remember it forever. Forever. And you can't just make the abstraction, the thing works like this. You've got to have a whole new part of your brain to be like, the things work like this, the other thing works like this. It's like, I have no idea how brains work. It's like twice as much brain memory. I don't know. You can't just index it. You've got to remember it. And if you're not perfect, you're going to get it wrong sometime, and you're not perfect because we're humans. There was this great talk at Lisa 2010 by John Adams from Twitter. He said that people kept overriding their auto config plus push by running chatter plus I on files. So when the config push rolled out, it would just not be able to change that file. And he said they got a team motto, you can't chatter plus I with broken fingers. And it sounded like that made things better. This is a really good talk, by the way. I recommend it. Like 6 years later, I still think about it. So I recommend it a lot. And it's presumably on the Usenix site somewhere. My favorite example of things that aren't like other things. Unix. Look, what does rm minus v do? It removes, verbosely. What does ln minus v do? It links, verbosely. Tar minus v? Tarchives, verbosely. What does pkill minus v do? Pkill minus v does not verbose. Pkill minus v negates the matching. It means do the opposite of what I just said. So an exception like this takes up a bit of mental space, but we forgive it because it's Unix, and it's kind of our family, and we love it. And like, 10K of your salary is based on knowing this exception. But then we make our own stuff, and what do we do? Like, this is recently I had to pull up the script that I had written a while ago, and And I knew what the arguments were. And I just like kept running it and it wasn't working and running it and it wasn't working. And look what I had done. The user's flag, comma separated list. The U-group's flag, take a comma separated list. The site's flag, regular expression. Why did I do that? Why would I do that? To make force myself to have to open up the script and have a look at it to see what it was expecting. This is a jerk thing to do to your future self. Here's a cookie. Don't force yourself to remember things. That is not a good use of your brain. Don't remember, you know, the one-offs, and just be really intolerant of things that are temporary solutions, because there's no such thing. And don't force yourself to read your dangerous documentation to proceed. Send yourself a cookie cutter shaped cookie. Make the things as identical as possible. Okay, another common predictability failure trap is great big threatening buttons. Look at that thing. Who doesn't want to press that button and see what happens? Do you know what won't happen? It won't say, this is what I do, are you sure? It won't. It'll just do a thing. And sometimes we might like it to say, is this what, you know, this is what I was going to do, are you sure? Like the pKill example above. It might be nice if it was like, yo, I'm going to kill all of your processes. Is that actually what you meant? Just checking. You can usually stop to ask questions. There are cases when you don't want to, but a lot of the time you can stop to ask, are you sure, even if you're only writing scripts for yourself. Partly because future you is a different person with different context, but also because a tool written just for yourself is sort of a big red button that you don't want other people to see. It's just sort of sitting somewhere convenient to you. And people will find it. Engineers are drawn to it. I don't know how that works. So you can't leave that sort of thing lying around. Like, say you're looking for a tool to delete old customer records. For some reason you don't have regular garbage collection, you got to do it manually. I don't know. And you dig around your tools directory and there's nothing. But you know your colleague did something similar recently. So you go look in their home directory. And look at that. There is a delete the badly typed records, damn, delete the badly typed records binary. So your colleague's not around to ask. What do you do? Maybe if you're paranoid, you might run file against it and see that it's a binary, so you can't just look at it. You might run strings on it and see if it says things like, I am deleting customer records, and it's like, yeah, that seems legit. A lot of people will run this minus H or minus minus help. A reasonable thing to do, because we're used to sane tools. We're used to things that say, I do X and I do Y. Would you like to add minus V to be verbose and or do the opposite of what I just said? But this one doesn't. It ignores all the flags and it just blows away the entire database. And your colleague comes back from lunch and is like, you did what? You did that in production? This is a script I wrote to blow away the test database in between continuous integration runs. You're not supposed to run it in production. You're not supposed to run it at all. It's for me. But it was a big red button just sitting there. And either way, no matter who's at fault, you're still going to spend the whole weekend recovering from tape, and that is not a fun thing to be doing because it was a big red button that was just sitting there. The postmortem says, this was a trap. There are good ways to pause and make sure that you and the tool have, you know, the same idea about what you're going to do as you proceed. I really like how GitHub does it. They have some text, which you're not going to read, and then they say, please type in the name of the repository. So you've got to prove that you have some basic awareness of your surroundings to move forward. And then you click a button that says, relatively briefly, this is what I'm going to do. A friend told me at his company they have, you know, you've got a checkbox to say, I have read this and I'm safe to proceed. They always add one checkbox for, I have not read this and I am just checking all the checkboxes. I love that. I think that's genius. So, right, the corollary to this is that sometimes the user wants to do things a bunch of times and they don't want to type yes to everyone. Like, you don't want, you know, I've used FSCK minus, minus Y or whatever. You want to say, I trust you to go do the right thing. And, you know, it's popular to add, a non-interactive mode. But sometimes this can go a little further and become a minus minus force. Like, I really think this tool will do the right thing in every circumstances, and that's really scary. Because the problem with that is that it applies force to every operation, not just to the one thing that needs to happen in superpower mode. Even better, people start depending on it, and they start documenting it. Has anyone ever said, like, if this thing doesn't work, then just run it again with minus force, or run it again with, like, run it again as root? I've worked with a tool that had minus minus force and minus minus force underscore all. I think force all implied force, but I'm not sure it did. They might have forced different things. That tool is a trap. That tool is not our friend. Like, very occasionally, you know, in olden times we used to SU root a lot and, you know, just sort of stomp around being super users and, I don't know, being like we were all B-O-F-H-O-M-G. But now we use sudo all the time because we recognize the need for more granular superpowers. You don't want to be the super user all the time. You got to choose to be it when you want to be it. The other way to do that is to have tools that do exactly one thing, make it incredibly clear what they do, and do it well. Here is... I think an often maligned tool that I think is kind of a wonderful thing, the emergency power off. I used to think that there was no point of these. They were, you know, they caused problems more often than they caused solutions until someone told me a story about a flooded machine room and an engineer reaching down into the water to unplug something and the CTO saying, holy crap, and hitting the EPO. And that was the right thing to do and maybe save someone's life. So EPOs are great. You can't bump them by accident. They're not, well, we hope so. That would be a badly designed EPO. You can't just power your whole data center down by accident. You have to really want to do it. It does one thing. It has very few words on it. It takes some force. You know, you gotta pull that thing pretty hard or push the thing really hard. So you know what you're doing. But most of the time, our superpowers are not highlighted in this way. Here's another true story. So someone I know was doing maintenance on a not very important system, and this thing had a tendency... when you were doing maintenance, it would page. And, you know, he liked the on-caller. He was a good guy. So he said, I'm going to silence all of the alerts for it before I start. And then, you know, it'll be fine. I think he might have been turning it down. So someone else had made a new nifty web interface to do exactly that. It was really cool. They were like, we're going to help you out. It was a single box, and you type into the box the regular expression that matched the kind of alerts you wanted to silence. And then in the background, it would check what you had rights to silence and silence what you had rights to do. Very helpful, very kind. So my friend wanted to silence all of the alerts, so he typed in dot star. What makes this story hilarious is that he had super user rights on the alert silencing system. So it silenced everything. Do you think it said, by the way, I am about to silence all of the alerts. Please type in, this seems like a remarkable life choice, to continue. It did not. It did not. But it was a quiet evening on call, and people still call him Dotstar, like 7 years later. And, you know, it's good. It's good that our tools try to help us out. I love, on my Ubuntu box, I love when I type in a command and it says, that's not installed. This is the command line to install the package. I think you can even set an environment variable that will say, hit yes to install the package now. I love that. That is so respectful of my time. Thank you, Ubuntu. What's less helpful is when it just assumes you know what it, you know, it knows what you mean. Like if it just installed the package and ran a random thing and was like, I think you mean this, is that cool? No. Here's another story that is almost entirely true about a thing I broke. So two great tastes that taste great together. Helpfulness and positional arguments. So imagine a script that starts or stops a program that is running in one of many countries, and it's something really important. Let's say it displays cat pictures. So it's globally distributed because you want low latency cat pictures around the world, and there's lots of them because you want high availability cat pictures around the world. And if I could get in an internally consistent cat picture, an eventually consistent cat picture joke in here, I would, but I couldn't. But I'm saying it anyway, so I'm meta making a joke. So as long as it's up and running in at least one place, you're all good, but if everything is down, then it's a sad catless morning. So there are two versions of this cat program. There's version one, which is, you know, cute cats, and version two, which is really cute cats. And sometimes you want to go to a different version. Like if Hacker News is getting too excited, you might want to change the version to, like, calm them down a little bit. And you've got the script to start and stop it. So here's the script. There are two fun facts about the script. Two helpful fun facts about the script. One is these are the versions. But if you get the version wrong, it'll just pick version 2. So you say version 3, it's like, no, you probably meant version 2, and it'll do it. That's helpful. Thank you, code writer. If you leave out the location, it'll do all of them. So that saves some typing. You know, if you suddenly want to add capacity, you want to bring up everything in the world, you just go start, V1, everything. It's great. So you use it something like this. Start V1 in Argentina, it'll bring up version 1 in Argentina. And if you don't have a sense of foreboding here again, it's probably another you've made good life choices. Because what does this do? The version is Cameroon, so we're going to use version 2. Yeah. And the location is everything. For bonus points, the person who wrote this script had added performance enhancement to not get in the way of the person running it. They had made the stop the thing or start the thing component of it not require any confirmation. Like, there was a flag for skip confirmation, which they had included. And this was a shell script. They made a for loop with an ampersand at the end of every row. So it all ran at once in the background. Parallel down. So the story, like I said, is almost entirely true. The way it's not true is that it wasn't Cat Picture Servers. It was Google's load balancers. And it was one of the most exciting moments of my life. 9 seconds. I sort of stared at this, and I hit the up arrow, and I changed the word stop to the word start, and I... and it was all fine. Nobody noticed. So this is a really, really dumb script that we immediately fixed. But there are so many examples of this. Like, you might have heard about the time Google erased, I don't know of all, but very many of its web servers. And it was the same thing. It was a, if you call this function with an empty list of disks to erase, then we will erase all of them. And I can even imagine this going for code review. And someone saying, that looks dangerous. And someone else saying, no, look, here at the call site, here where we call this function, we make sure that it's never empty. And that seems reasonable, sure, looks good to me. But then maybe later someone refactored the code to move the safety check just a little further away, or maybe someone thought, hey, that's a useful function, I'll call it from somewhere else. And the code happily started erasing all of the servers. This is a trap. If your code can be called in a way that will cause a massive outage, let's assume that it will be. You got to put safety checks right up beside the thing that is doing the damage, because, you know, if a user can walk around the safety check by accident or like, oh, what's over here? You know they will. It's like a fundamental truth of SRE. Things will go wrong. SRE, and I should say SRE and sysadmining and DevOps and whatever else we call ourselves this week, stuff will break. People will find a way to break stuff. The universe provides a way. And when they do break, we need to make it as obvious as possible what has just broken. Like, we got to decide what to do. So we can make it hard. We do make it hard for ourselves to find out what's going on. Like, I really apologize for this terrible joke, but for having millions of tiny problems that never get fixed because everyone has memorized that they're there. It's a snowflake thing again. You know, you get paged by something, you go look at the logs, and the first log line is, you're like, oh no, that's always there. And then the second one, it's like, yeah, I think that's been broken for a while, just that's not the problem. And you work through the logs, and you hit something, and you're like, is that usual? And you go look at it, the same a different server that does the same thing, or you go look at it last week. And in the middle of all this, there might be a log line that is like, this is the breakage, but it's so obscured by all the other things that are not actually broken. So give yourself a cookie with this. Like, when you see these errors, either fix them or file a bug to fix them. One thing I really like for this is fix-it weeks. Do people do that sort of thing? Is this, this is just us? Okay. As you go through the quarter, note all of these small things that drive you crazy. Like, maybe it adds 30 seconds to your debugging, but it was 30 annoyed seconds, and you really didn't want to, you know, you didn't want to be paged just then anyway. And plan 1 week a quarter, plan it in advance, like a project, where your team goes through this list and fixes all of the stuff. And people will pick the low-hanging fruit, but that's okay, because that means you've got more of the small things fixed. And then offer a prize to whoever closes the most. When my team did it, I gave them the winner a box of lollipops that were shaped like eyeballs with forks stuck in them, because that's, you know, that represented the things that we were trying to fix. Similarly, like you're all getting paged for things that are true but are not really urgent. Or getting paged for like a single task burping, so you spend all your time debugging that, and then when a real problem comes in, you're too fried to reason about it. Often there's key context that determines whether you need to act at all. Like, the disk is at 90%, should you page? Well, it's been at 89% for 5 years, so we're probably okay. We probably don't need to get somebody out of bed. So you can add runbooks or playbooks as well. You can add context that is like, this is how you find out whether this is a real problem. Ideally, it doesn't page if it's not. But you can add a link to all of your alerts. Do people use runbooks, by the way? Yeah? Yeah, someone. So every alert will have a link to a short document that explains what you need to know and only you need to know. So you're tired, it's 3 a.m., you really didn't want to be paged. Here is information written clearly that you can swap into your brain to solve the problem. There's also alerting on success. My friend had a an online clothing company told me that his systems people get a mail when every backup starts and a mail when it stops. And I don't know if it's a different subject line if it fails, but I don't think anyone's reading those mails. It's just my theory. So the final trap I'm going to talk about is fear. My colleague, John Reese, calls these haunted graveyards. He talks about the parts of production that people are just scared to touch. Like a library that was written by some psychopath in 2004, and it's this maze of twisty callbacks and scary pointer arithmetic, and there's this variable that it doesn't seem to do anything, but everyone's afraid to remove it because it might be structural. And the library is used by everyone, so if we don't make eye contact with it or try to rebuild it, we're probably fine, right? In olden times, people often had a server that they were afraid to reboot because they weren't sure it would come back up. I heard of one server that had a floppy disk that people were afraid to eject because they weren't sure the hardware could take it. The longer you leave it, the worse it gets. Like, you're like, can we fail over to the other data center? Let's not and say we did, you know? If you've got processes or code you're afraid of, you really need to break them now on your own terms while you're looking at it. For a haunted graveyard, you just go in there and hang some lights, have a party in there, just own the situation. The other kind of fear, and the one weird trick for making your production environment entirely unmanageable, is blame. It's the surest thing you can do to hide problems, is make people get in trouble for causing the problems. Because there's no way they'll tell you when they broke it. My favorite on call shift, and I use that expression very, very advisedly. So I was on call for Google's monitoring system, New Year's Day. And the thing that pages, it's the thing that pages all the other teams. All of the servers that do that, they went down and then they came back up in perfect synchronicity. I was like, okay, that's not great. Wait a few seconds, and then they did it again. Like, okay, so I'm debugging, it's New Year's morning, and I can't see what the problem is. It feels like a query of death, but I don't know. So I mailed half the planet, it felt like. It's like, I can't believe I'm sending mail to so many people, but there are a lot of people who will be interested in this situation. And I was like, I'm sorry I haven't been able to debug this yet. If you get paged, it might not alert you. Just keep an eye on your alerts. By the time I had alt-tab back to debug, I had an IM from someone saying, oh yeah, I was trying a thing, I'll stop that. It's like, thank you. That is the best possible outcome of a situation like that. Like, we learned from this is a while ago, and we learned from this outage like we learned from every outage, and the system is way more robust now. But I would also argue that an outage like this makes your whole organization more robust. Like, if it's safe for someone to be like, oh yeah, I broke that was me, then that's a person who can do their best, most comfortable work. And equally, if it's safe for me to send a mail to a lot of people saying, I can't debug this without feeling like, oh my goodness, everyone will think I am so stupid, that means the length of the outage will get much shorter. It's really important to have blameless postmortems. We talk about that all the time. But I would go a step even further. Here is the cookie. Here's what you do when someone breaks something. You say thank you. You say thank you for finding the edge case. You say thank you for highlighting this part of our production that is really complicated and this hole in our documentation. That is like a whole box of cookies for future you. And then, you go make it so no one can break it the same way again. While I'm here, public service announcement. Log the query before you run it, not afterwards. Do this as a favor to your on-call person, because if it's a query of death, they'll never be able to figure it out. It's really hard. Thank you for your time. Whoa! I have more. I'm sorry. I mean thank you for my public service announcement. So, Lordy. All this complexity, it's like we want to make our jobs hard, to prove we're smart. But senior engineers write simpler code. They write simpler systems. Again and again, you will have opportunities to choose traps or cookies. Are we recapping? We're recapping. Remember that you, your colleagues, your users, whoever, they don't want to read your doc. So when you're writing a doc, they will read it in entirely the wrong order. They will blindly copy and paste whatever you give them. They will use it as it is. And they'll skim through the context if you're lucky. If you're unlucky, they won't even look at the context. They will search for words that are not the words you're using, so you can add all the words that they might search for. That's helpful. It's good helpful. When you're writing monitoring, you can, think about what present you likes to do. Is it be on call? Is it be paged? It is probably not. Future you probably also doesn't want to be paged. So don't page them unless something's happening that they need to react to. Don't waste their emergency response adrenaline. If it's not urgent, there are better ways to deal with it. File a bug, open a ticket, have a fix-it week. and give them all the information in runbooks or directly in the alert to fix the situation. I think it's really, really easy to understand why the alert's firing. When you're making scripts, don't ask your people to resist buttons. They can't help it. Engineers are drawn to poke things to see what they do. Even if you're building them for yourself, don't leave them sitting around and make them ask. Make them check before doing anything dangerous. And be really clear about what's going to happen. Granular with superpowers. And if you ever suspect the user doesn't know what you're about to do, just make sure that you agree on context. When you're running systems, don't waste your brain on dumb stuff. Waste your brain on fun stuff. Use your brain on fun stuff. So fight one-offs, temporary solutions, break stuff now while you're looking real hard at it, and clean up all the noise that hides your real problems. Again, simple. Finally, after an incident, all the stuff that went wrong that was not related to your incident but stopped you from debugging it, those are all still bugs. They're part of your incident, they're part of your postmortem. They need to be fixed. If the outage is caused by human error, find out why they made that error. It's probably not because they're dumb, and even if it is, humans are dumb sometimes. We just are. And above all, never be that guy. But what it all boils down to is being predictable. I seriously love this picture. There's like this whole series of pictures with her emoting various feelings. It's all public domain, so I can use it in every presentation for the rest of my life. Even better, go above and beyond for future you and your future colleagues. So like you can write notes to them being like, you're going to be tempted to do this thing. Don't. This is why. Or adding all of the search terms that they could possibly want. And you will be glad to see these messages from the past. You'll thank future you. So when you do inherit, a mysterious package or a library or an entire production environment, then you don't have to stop and stare at it for a long time and be like, what? Is that future past person? What are they doing? Did they like me? And what is going to be in here? You can just know that this is going to be awesome. So now this is actually the end. I hate Q&A, and I was mostly not going to want to do that, but I'm going to take a cue from Jessica Hill's talk earlier today and say questions are okay if they're very nice. But mostly, I want to let people share their most exciting disasters. I've just given you a list of things I have broken. And I bet people here have broken things in interesting ways, maybe, yeah? So I invite you to tell me things you personally, not other people, have broken. And thank you to the great nation of Germany for the word Schadenfreude, which is the enjoyment in someone else's misfortune. It's really good. Who has a story about a thing they've broken? Thank you.
So I was the sysadmin at a small university department, and it was time to upgrade the server to a new version of Solaris. Had everyone's mail on and home directory and everything. And I very, very carefully went through and made sure that the disk targeted for installation was not going to be the one that had all the home directories and all the mail spool files. And what I didn't realize, because I hadn't read all through the release notes, was that the way of numbering disks had changed. So I very, very helpfully installed all over the home directories and the mail spools for this server. And what was meant to be a routine prisoner transfer turned into a long session restoring from tape. So that's what I did.
Love it. Thank you.
I was working on servers that had customer data on them, each one of them being single points of failure. And so before, I was doing a patch on the servers. And before each one, I had to move customer data off and then patch the server and move it back on. So we had like a 40-step runbook to do this. And I move the traffic off, I check everything, I get prepared, and then I reboot the wrong server. But it came back up under SLA, so it's fine.
Hooray for error budgets.
So I look after an Elasticsearch cluster. It's a pretty large Elasticsearch cluster. And at one point, we were killing it with the rate of ingestion from a data store. And so you can throttle Elasticsearch. You can tell it to slow down everything. And it's great, because the option for it is max bytes per second. Nobody thinks in terms of bytes. Everyone thinks in terms of megabytes. And so we throttled it, dropped the mic, went home, and killed everything.
So I don't have a story, but 2 years ago there was a buff on this exact subject where people were explaining fails, but under the pretense that it was this unnamed colleague at my former job that did something. And that buff concept is actually really fun, so maybe we should set up one for tonight and have stories like this. It's usually very, very fun.
Oh yeah, I would go to that. Would you set up?
Sure, I can write it on the board if I find a spot.
Yeah, definitely.
So I was new to the team, and I was examining our software-based, our Linux-based load balancer, and I was wondering how the IP addresses were maintained. And I asked a colleague, "Does he use IP tables?" He goes, "I don't know." So we looked together and ran IP tables -L, capital L. Okay, nothing there. Maybe it's using the NAT. Maybe it's using the NAT filter, the NAT table. So IP tables -T, NAT -L. Nope, nothing there. Immediately, a few moments later, the server begins to fail because we've accidentally loaded the NF contract driver into the Linux kernel, because IP table does that for you without saying, without helpfully asking, "Oh, by the way, I'm loading some drivers for you. I hope you like them," especially this one that has a default simultaneous connection limit of 65,535 connections. So it took us a while to figure that out because we didn't, well, like an hour, because we didn't realize we had done it. But and the answer was, of course, later on, we is a way to alias drivers in Linux, so we made sure that driver could never get loaded ever again.
So most power supplies have a little red switch on the back that says whether they're going to expect 110 or 220 volts. Sometimes you remember to switch it.
So I was a newbie developer at the time, and our customer had just pushed a new website, and they're like, "Hey, Lisa, can you, you know, set it up?" And I'm like, "Sure, no problem." Drop database. In my defense, it was a beta test, so it was okay.